Well, I haven't had the opportunity to interview Dr. Richard Friedland, the Chief Executive of Netcare, since December 2021. Those of you who have some memories may recall that he said at the time it looks like Omicron was not the next terrible wave that was going to hurt us with COVID. He said it looks like COVID may well be the worst behind us. My goodness, he was right. Everybody else seemed to be wrong at the time. And it wasn't long afterwards that we got back to normality. So he's got another big story for us today. Richard, good to be talking with you. You know, it's hard to imagine now how impactful that interview of yours was in December 2021. The whole country was in almost paralysis over the COVID crisis. And you said, hang on, there is bright light. We at Netcare are seeing things that we did not expect. And it appears as though the worst is over. Of course, not too many people believed you right then. But my goodness, you were on the money.
Yeah, thank you, Alec. Those were terrible times in our country's history and, in fact, globally. And, you know, the tragic loss of life was shocking. In our organization, we lost 75 frontline heroes. But I was able to speak from a position of authority because I was on the floor. I was in our hospitals and I could see the difference in the fourth wave. This wasn't some theoretical construct that an academic or an epidemiologist or statistician was making. And so I did come in for enormous criticism and flack. But the reality on the ground was very different from the third wave, the second and the first wave. And so I was able to say, based on that, we believe it's different. And we then went to publish our results in the journal, the JAMA, the Journal of American Medical Association. And we were the first to come out with this. But as you say, hugely controversial. But then I've never been afraid to stick out my neck if I believe that what we're saying is the truth.
Well, you've been running Netcare for coming up for two decades. We'll talk about your departure in a moment. But let's start off with the address that you gave yesterday to the Hospitals Association of South Africa, because right now the whole subject of National Health Insurance, NHI, is, as you said in that address, extremely polarizing. For those who don't know South Africa but do know America, it feels like we're a bit going into the American election. You're either with Trump or Kamala. And in this case, on NHI, you're either with it or against it, or so it seems. And yet, there has to be, as you explained, a middle way. And that's what we'd like to unpack with you today.
Yeah, certainly. And I want to contextualize it in the fact that I think we all recognize healthcare is in crisis in our country. And we're at the crossroads at a very pivotal time in terms of healthcare delivery and access. And the debate is, as you say, very polarized. We've got to put an end to the divisive rhetoric that has characterized the debate and the polarization of either NHI or no NHI. And what we're suggesting is a middle ground, a return to, you know, a reform that was suggested, in fact, was part of ANC policy in 1994, was also part of government policy in 1997. And was contemplated when the Medical Schemes Act was put together in 1998, but never fully implemented. And what we're saying is that actually this is informed by over two decades of very significant research policy papers, this idea of mandatory cover for all of those formerly employed. And we only have to look around the world at where this works. You'd be surprised to know, Alec, that in over 61% of African countries, there's some form of mandatory cover. There's mandatory cover in China, in Japan, and many Asian countries, in Latin America and the Caribbean, and in Europe. And we think that this is a viable solution.
When I was reading through the speech, I was just trying to find parallels to how this might be. And recalling the time that I worked for a corporate, you had mandatory pensions, 6% of my salary went into a pension fund, and that was matched by the company. Are there similar, or do you see similar things here, that if you are employed by a company, in other words, you have full-time employment, that you become the responsibility partly of yourself and the company for your medical cover rather than the state.
Yes, absolutely. But there are different mechanisms to achieve that based on affordability levels. And we're very confident, having done a lot of actuarial analysis with our actuaries, that this will come at a substantially lower cost and far more affordable than what is contemplated by the NHI. Remember, Alec, the NHI is contemplating increasing the spend of $271 billion by $200 billion. But that's a figure that goes back to 2010 and 2011. You know, BRUSA and B4SA estimate it's closer to $500 billion. We simply can't afford that. And, you know, if I may just mention with it, if you were to raise that kind of money, you can do it in one of three ways. Let's assume you do it through corporate tax. Well, that's an increase of 75% on corporate tax to 47%. If you were going to do it on personal income tax, that's 31%. And heaven forbid we should tackle that. Well, you've got to take that from 15 to 21.5%. That's 43%. We can't afford it. And so this is a far more affordable way of achieving it. And the most important element is getting mandatory cover, because that means everyone who's employed is covered. And we deal with this issue of anti-selection, where only those who are sick remain on a scheme and the healthy remain out of it. And so what you find with mandatory cover is that the rich subsidize the poor, the young subsidize the old, and the healthy subsidize the unwell. And what actuaries are telling us is that you can reduce medical aid contributions anywhere up to 30% almost overnight if you can achieve the additional mandatory cover that we're calling for and risk equalization. And so we want to have the chance to discuss this with our partners in government and decide on what should be that minimum benefit package that is affordable for everyone.
But presumably someone's going to pay for this in the private sector. It sounds a bit of a public-private partnership in a way. You're taking responsibility for employees away from the government. Would it not hurt the employment issues? In other words, smaller businesses saying, well, I can't really employ this person because I'm going to have to pay their medical aid on top of everything else.
You raise a very valid point, and I think for small businesses and others, there are solutions. Again, we want to be able to take this to government to make sure that, yes, that this burden on corporate South Africa or on the South African public is limited, but it is certainly far more affordable than what is being suggested by the NHI. And I can tell you this, Alec, that we forget the enormous benefit, and this has been demonstrated globally in thousands of studies, the wonderful books on it, the impact of improved healthcare on the country, on the economy's well-being, and the decline in absenteeism. And we've got to get this economy going. You know, Alec, everyone talks about inequity and inequality. And whether you look at food security, or you look at housing, or you look at education, and particularly in healthcare, but what is the root cause? Alec, the root cause is we have one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, over 32%. Global average is 5%. We simply have to tackle unemployment and growth in this country in order to be able to afford the kind of ambitious schemes that the NHI is suggesting without crippling the economy. So within a limited funding envelope, and with the kinds of levels of unemployment that we have in our country, this is a viable option, and it's one that's affordable and comes at a fraction of the cost that taxpayers would ordinarily have to fork out. And the biggest single advantage of this, Alec, is the fact that it's not just covering those that are formerly employed. And remember, we're saying it should be in a gradual stepwise, those above the tax threshold and then finally those below. But if we're able to achieve that, it puts 27.5 million of our population out of 63 million. So it moves significantly from the 9.2 million currently covered to 27.5 million, and leaves the government, instead of looking after 85% of the population, looking after 35 million people, which is closer to 58% of the population. And I think that what that does is says, without increasing government's coffers, your per capita spend now on those that are indigent and unemployed increases by 52%. You know, it increases from about 5,000 rand to about 7,600 rand odd. And that's a very, very significant increase. If you look at the 200 billion alone that government's seeking to raise, that takes them to 7,500 per capita. And so I think that the benefits of reducing the massive waiting lists, the overcrowding, allowing for health systems strengthening in the public sector, a focus on improving infrastructure, and probably the most important, because we can't deliver healthcare with robots, is filling unfunded and vacant posts of nurses and doctors in the public sector, and having the money to fund training. We've got to train double the number of nurses, Annie, if we want to deliver any system. We've got to train doctors. I've shown in that presentation, you know, by any standard, we have a shortage of doctors per 100,000 of the population. So the benefits to the public sector are enormous, besides those to those employed as we drive the economy. And the real benefit is if the government of national unity gets its act together, as they have with peers with Eskom, and we can drive employment growth, the benefits to Treasury and the public sector multiply, because as the population is becoming more active and more employed, their burden of delivering healthcare is actually not increasing. So, you know, we've got to look at this as a real partnership in collaboration and cooperation between the different sectors to find something that really works. And I want to just say this, if I may. You know, it's been estimated by people in government this will take 10 to 15 years, and don't worry about it. The truth is we must worry about it. We can deliver a solution now, and we need that solution. We all know that. And this is simply putting on the table legislation that was contemplated but not finally gazetted in 2000 or in 1998.
Why wasn't it gazetted back then?
I can't answer that exactly. I know that in 1997, the National Department of Health, Social Health Insurance Working Group advocated for mandatory cover, but they suggested only starting with those above the tax threshold from an affordability perspective. And so we're also suggesting that let's take that as a first step. And as the economy grows and we can create jobs, and we improve productivity, we can consider those below the tax line. And then ultimately, you know, there's a third and fourth phase as the economy expands. We can allow there to be an NHI type of fund for the public sector. So, you know, the possibilities of building on this platform are endless. But we need to do this in collaboration and cooperation. And, you know, people often say to me, well, Richard, this is a lofty ideal, but it's a lot of nonsense. You don't have the capacity for this. Well, we presented the capacity at the Health Summit, President's Health Summit and Job Summit in 2018, and we employed experts to look at it. And it showed the private sector can take up to 14 million people. So we do have the capacity, and without going to recreate infrastructure and enormous capital investment, we can absorb a very significant part of our working force.
So I guess the starting point would be to go back to that act in the early days of South Africa's democracy and to maybe, again, reassess why it wasn't promulgated then. Rather than at the moment, I'm sure you saw the speech that the Minister of Health gave or read the speech that he gave yesterday to the International Pharmaceutical Conference in Cape Town, where he started likening the resistance to NHI to swart gevaar and white people stocking up on candles and tinned food. Well, I don't know any white people who did that, and I certainly didn't. But anyway, it's a lovely myth that can get trotted out that was supposedly happened in 1994, but it does appear as though you've got these very, very strong factions on both sides. And how are you going to break through to get some maturity, some logic, some rationality into this argument with what you've proposed?
Well, Alec, I think you make a very good point, but I don't think we must be distracted or put off by divisive rhetoric. And we must see it for what it is. And this is not about an individual or an individual person. This is about what's the best for South Africa and what's affordable and what is sustainable. And, you know, we can all talk about the legal issues of the NHI Act, and yes, there will be legal action. This is a real viable solution. And what we said yesterday is that it's not just about this. There are tons of private sector, public-private initiatives that we can assist government with. Training is a massive example. You know, we know that we're training 5,900 people at the moment in nursing. We have to train double that amount by 2030. We've got 28,000 nurses short in the moment, and we've got to train 70,000 by the year 2030. But we've actually got to train 87,000 because 50% of our registered nurses, and most of them in the public sector, I might point out, are nearing retirement. Now, we've said to government, we'll take up the flak on those extra 50%, the doubling that you have to train. We have the capacity. You know, we're training 68% less because of new regulations and a change in curricula, and we respect that. It's been a long time. And so the private sector stands ready to help train doctors. It stands ready to help train nurses, to twinning of hospitals. There is enormous cooperation on the ground between us as healthcare workers, between various hospitals and public institutions. However, as it reaches the public echelons, we get caught in this unnecessary and divisive rhetoric. And this is about a partnership. It's about us all coming together. And I would suggest that we're not distracted by this kind of language. It's divisive. It's unnecessary. And we've got to look at real commonality and more that unites us as opposed to that which divides us.
Perhaps to look on the optimistic side, politicians love flying kites. And then everyone celebrates when the proposal is brought back to normality. In other words, pushing the envelope aggressively, as has happened with NHI, there can't be too many people who can see a possibility of the tax increases that we're talking about, 21.5% for VAT. It just sounds absurd. But at least if we then get the creative juices going around the economy, as appears to be happening right now in the proposals that you've brought, then everybody can celebrate a victory. Both sides can save face, if you like. Do you think that could be where we're heading?
I think it's always about the sacrifice of common purpose, Alec, in terms of what's good for South Africa. Why are we doing this? Because we care. Because we all care about the future of South Africa, and we all recognize that healthcare is a universal right. Of course we do. And it's because of that very reason we've got to come together and find something that is rational, affordable, sustainable, and utilizes the current strengths as opposed to trying to break everything down and recreate something. We have strengths within the various sectors of South Africa that stand willing, completely willing to participate. And in complete contrast, the kind of rhetoric now being floated out on various podiums, you know, we don't need that, and we're not going to respond to it. We're going to respond to a clarion call for partnership in this regard. And I think there is a middle ground to be found. Ultimately, we've got to put patients first. And I think the public sector is unfortunately in dire straits. And this proposal really removes an enormous burden from them at a time when they just don't have the capacity, they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have the doctors and nurses. We have a shortage. And, you know, there are mechanisms to help fund that and improve on it. But it has to be in collaboration and cooperation. And we're looking forward to that engagement in that regard. And we're not going to be distracted by, unfortunately, divisive rhetoric and that kind of language.
We have a government of national unity. We have lots of people talking about public-private partnerships. And here's a working model, or a model that everyone accepted 20 years ago, not even 20 years ago, but has never really been implemented. Dr. Richard Friedland is the chief executive of Netcare, who's raised this issue at the Hospital Association of South Africa yesterday. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.